You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 10th of May 2021 on Monocle 24. The Briefing is brought to you in association with Novartis. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. Coming up on today's programme, we'll have the latest from Israel after several days of violent protest, as an Israeli nationalist celebration seems unlikely to calm things. Later in the show...
It seems as though the Republican Party is trying to identify what it stands for, and they're in the midst of... significant mini-revolution.
As the GOP prepares to move against one of its more formidable mainstream figures, we'll ask the Lincoln Project's Rick Wilson what the party he once worked for thinks it is doing. Also ahead...
We have changed as a party, but we've not made a strong enough case to the country. We've lost that connection, that trust, and I intend to rebuild that and do whatever is necessary to rebuild that trust.
Sir Keir Starmer, leader of the UK's Labour Party, attempts to absorb the lessons of mixed results in local, mayoral and, in Wales and Scotland, national elections. And Monocle's Nick Manise will be here for a roundup of the week's best urbanism stories as well. That's all coming up right here on The Briefing on Monocle 24. Welcome to today's edition of The Briefing with me, Andrew Muller. Later today, Israel's capture of East Jerusalem in the Six-Day War of 1967 will be commemorated, as usual, by the annual Jerusalem Day flag march. On the basis of the last few days, it is difficult to imagine it going altogether smoothly. Hundreds of Palestinian demonstrators and dozens of Israeli police have been injured in several days of disturbances around Palestinian protests against threatened evictions. The violence has spread to Haifa, Ramallah, and the always hypersensitive site of the Al-Aqsa Mosque in the Temple Mount compound in Jerusalem's Old City. Well, joining me with more on this from Tel Aviv is Alison Kaplan-Sommer, a journalist at Haaretz. Alison, first of all, to the disturbances we've seen over the last few days, how significant do they seem by, I guess, local standards?
They seem very significant. We haven't had anything this violent and this large in several years. Really, time will tell if this is going to be a long-term problem. But right now, you know, we're focused on the celebration of Ramadan, coinciding with Jerusalem Day, which is also always a very provocative time of year. But I would say that we haven't seen anything on this scale in many years, and it's got Israel very concerned.
We'll come to Jerusalem Day itself shortly, but first, these protests about evictions from the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. What is the backstory there?
Well, there's a long backstory there. There is a movement of Jewish settlers, of many organizations supporting them, who point back to pre-1948 and say, you know, these were originally Jewish-owned homes, and they want to reclaim them, and they want to buy them, and Arab families are being forced out of their homes, in people who are claiming that they have legal agreements to purchase the houses, but the families are not leaving. And the issue has been in court for a very long time, and it's become the focus of many protests.
And the Jerusalem Day march itself, and you're right in pointing out that the coincidence of Jerusalem Day and Ramadan was always likely to be tense. But how big a deal is it usually, and who tends to attend it?
Well, it's got a history. It used to be, you know, much more sort of a general celebration that the entire population participated in, and it was considered a very national festive day. Really, I would say, you know, over the past decade, it's had an increasingly political taint, and the right wing has pretty much co-opted it as their celebration. Right wing religious Israelis march through the Old City in what is often, you know, very clear provocations against Palestinians living there, waving flags, singing, dancing. So many people in that camp, you know, they would still claim and consider that this is just something festive. They're celebrating Israel's getting the Old City, the Western Wall, many of its holy places returned to it. But many in the right have, as I said, co-opted the holiday and turned it into a sort of a festival of their camp.
The footage we've seen of Israeli police firing tear gas and baton rounds on the Temple Mount has led a few people to reach for comparisons with Ariel Sharon's visit to the Temple Mount in 2000, which is, of course, widely blamed for tipping off the Second Intifada. Is there a concern that what we've seen already could escalate, if not necessarily to that scale, but could still significantly get worse?
Well, as I said, people are sort of in a wait and see mode to see if this is something very short and intense, or if it's something more long term. I have to add, you know, to the list of factors, the fact that the Palestinian elections in the Palestinian Authority were canceled, which I think has sort of added to the level of frustration going on. But there's a lot of finger pointing going on as to who's starting the violence and who's doing the provocations. The Israeli side points to stones and fireworks being stockpiled in the Temple Mount area and the Palestinians beginning to use them. And of course, the Palestinian side is outraged by the very intensive, very heavy countermeasures of the tear gas and the attacks in the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which they consider very holy, the rubber bullets. The situation's escalated today, and there's been an event where a man driving in Jerusalem has been, was surrounded by rock-throwing Palestinians, and it's being called an attempted lynch mob.
This also all happens at a time at which Israeli politicians are trying to figure out who or what Israel's next actual government will be. Does that uncertainty cloud the official response at all?
Well, definitely. I think if Benjamin Netanyahu wasn't so focused on the political goings-on and particularly focused on his own corruption trial, that he might take a higher profile in standing up against this. The political arena is in a certain amount of confusion, and therefore, you know, we're seeing a lot of police and a lot of army figures take the screens and being in the forefront, but we're not, we don't have a lot of high-profile politicians, it seems, taking charge of the situation.
Alison Kaplan-Sommer from Haaretz, thank you for joining us. You're listening to The Briefing. Here is Monocle's Paige Reynolds with the day's other headlines.
Thanks, Andrew. India's Defence Ministry has announced that it will recruit hundreds of former army medics in a bid to support the country's embattled healthcare system. The decision comes as India grapples with staggering numbers of COVID-19 infections and deaths amid calls for a complete nationwide lockdown. South Korea's President Moon Jae-in says he sees his final year in office as the last chance to achieve a lasting peace with North Korea. Moon's comments, which mark the fourth year of his presidency, come ahead of his first summit with the US President Joe Biden. And the future of Radio Canada International is reportedly in doubt because of the restructuring process at national broadcaster CBC. Radio Canada International has been an important part of the country's soft power offering since its founding in 1945. For more, head to monocle.com/minute. Those are the day's headlines. Back to you, Andrew.
Thank you, Paige. You are listening to The Briefing with me, Andrew Muller. There were those who anticipated, or at least hoped, that last November's loss of the US presidency by Donald Trump might prompt the Republican Party he led to return to its senses and to its core values of stolid, sensible, practical conservatism. On current form, that weight might have a while to run. House Republicans are poised to remove Wyoming Congresswoman Liz Cheney from her position as House Republican Congress Chair. Cheney, daughter of former Republican Vice President Dick Cheney, has repeatedly committed the apparent heresy of suggesting that Donald Trump was, in certain key respects, less than a paragon. Well, joining me now from Florida is Rick Wilson, the former Republican political strategist and co-founder of the Lincoln Project. Rick, first of all, if they do succeed in throwing Liz Cheney out of her current position, what would that symbolize in terms of the direction the Republican Party is taking?
Well, I think it is now essentially an inevitability that she will be removed from her position as conference chair. And it is also highly likely that she will be primaried by a person far, far, far on the Trump right and lose her seat. So I think it's almost a foregone conclusion at this point. But it is a very sharp, very clear division in what the party once was, and what the Trump iteration of the Republican Party represents. And it is now a nativist, conspiracy-driven party of that is much more similar to a personality cult than a political party. And as you said, she's committed the sin over and over of not accepting the big lie. And what is the big lie? The big lie is that Trump won the election, that Trump is still the legitimate president, that Trump is somehow, through a combination of voter fraud, global conspiracy, and, you know, lizard alien, you know, QAnon conspiracy crazies, has been somehow denied, you know, his second term. And she won't do it. And that's to her credit. But it is also something that, you know, the inevitability in the Republican Party of the power of folks like Matt Gaetz and Marjorie Taylor Greene and Jim Jordan is now cemented. And that means that Trump's role as the central power of all Republicanism in the U.S. is now completely, you know, not even an open question any longer.
But when you look at things like this, and not just this, of course, this is, and it's even not just the last 4 years, this is rot that has been setting in from a way back. But right now, does the Republican Party, which you once worked for, strike you as an organization that is, according, you know, to its own merits and in its own interests, actually pursuing some sort of coherent strategy? Or is this an organization, and it happens, which has just collectively lost its mind?
Well, there is no further there's no policy now inside the Republican Party. There is no ideology. There is no philosophy. It has now been reduced essentially to, as they say, owning the libs and a sort of collective hatred of the media fueled by malign and insane conspiracy theories. There is no there. It is, the party is whatever Trump wants that day. If Donald Trump tomorrow said, we're going to participate in a goat sacrifice once a week to glorify me, every Republican would be out buying a goat to sacrifice. It sounds comical, but it's really not. He is the sole power in the party. Mitch McConnell can strut and preen and pretend he's got control of it. But the minute Donald Trump decides Mitch McConnell's not in power anymore, he's not in power anymore. The minute, you know, any of these candidates who claim they want to be, the next president actually start campaigning for the job, Trump will destroy them. He runs the party. He controls the party. People who believe that Donald Trump is, that, as they say, the former guy, or that he's just going to disappear, are not paying attention.
I mean, you referred to it as a personality cult, and as you describe it, that's probably an accurate characterization. Is that all it is? I guess the question is any kind of Trumpism possible without Trump, or is it just about him?
It is solely and exclusively about him. And perhaps to the extension of his family to some smaller degree. But there is nothing there without him. He is the defining characteristic of the party now. There's no secondary ideological reality to it. Now, they may have some things, some trappings that they claim or that they sort of hold to of love the police and hate Antifa, but those things are just decorative. They're signifiers. It is now this is Donald Trump's political machine and his power base, and that's how he operates it, and that's how it's going to be, in the actuality and the execution. That's what it's going to be from now forward.
I mean, that being the case, do you think the Republican Party is fixable or salvageable, or does everybody else just need to wait for this to play itself out one way or the other?
Well, I think as they say down south, you know, it's dead, but it's too dumb to lay down. And I think that's where we're at right now. I think the party as a ideological force, as a political force, as a policy force, has exhausted itself, in the throes of Trumpism. And until they have a sharp electoral pain, which is not necessarily coming in the immediate future, I think they're going to continue to sort of run this out because it's easy. And that's one thing that people don't really understand about Trumpism. It's easy. And because it's easy, They don't have to think about anything. They don't have to propose any real policies other than just pure obstructionism. They'll continue to do it.
I mean, the question then prompted, and I think you're probably quite right, when you don't need to come up with any positive policies and all you need to do is claim that your opponents are bad, mendacious, evil, and so on, it is a fairly easy shift to put in. But is there any way that anybody else in politics, whether they're the Democrats or relatively sane conservatives such as those attached to the Lincoln Project, can actually do to address that? I mean, are there people in thrall to Trumpism who you can actually still reach?
There's a very small number, and as we call it inside the Lincoln Project, we call it the game of small numbers. I mean, last year we didn't have to go out and win a million votes in Michigan. We needed to win about 60,000 votes. Many of these states are so closely divided, and under our electoral college system, you have to play those very small angles, those very small numbers. You have to be willing to go out and do a lot of math and a lot of hunting to find that pool of voters that you need. Now, that doesn't mean you can win, you know, a large binary partisan conquest in most cases. It is extraordinarily difficult to do that in this day and age. So, you know, the Republican Party, the primaries will become more and more purist and Trumpist. The general elections, you know, will become more and more closely divided in many of the key swing states. And so it's important that we treat it with realism, and we understand that the party is not the creature. You can't have sentimentality about what the Republican Party was in the past. Look, I got my start working for George Herbert Walker Bush back when I was, you know, 23 years old. That party is dead. It's gone. It's over. I mean, George Bush could no more get elected today than I could. So we have to be really realistic about what motivates the current Republican Party, who they really are, what they believe, and how they're going to behave going forward.
Rick Wilson of the Lincoln Project, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24.
Novartis is proud to partner The Briefing on Monocle 24. Novartis is a company that is committed to reimagining medicine. The global healthcare leader intent on changing the practice of medicine, Novartis has been exploring uncharted frontiers in science for more than a century. Today, the company is working on breakthrough treatments that push the boundaries of human understanding in biology, data science, and engineering to develop and deliver therapies that help people live longer and healthier lives around the world. Novartis. Reimagining medicine.
You are back with The Briefing on Monocle 24. I'm Andrew Muller. The votes of last week's local, mayoral and indeed national elections across the United Kingdom have now been counted. The picture is mixed sufficiently for pretty much everyone to claim that it all proves that what they had been saying all along was exactly right. But what it does seem to demonstrate is that the UK's Labour Party faces a long and vexingly winding road back to overall national power. If there was an overall trend, it was that the incumbent parties in England, Wales and Scotland all did pretty well. Well, let's get the latest now with George Parker, political editor at the Financial Times. George, first of all, one of the obvious fallouts of the election has been Labour's reshuffle, that is at a national level. What lessons does Labour seem to have decided to learn?
Well, they've learned that they've been going, we thought that the 2019 general election was about as low as the Labour Party could fall, particularly in England. It was their worst election result since 1935, but the local elections showed that they could fall further still. So there was all-round panic in the Labour leader's office, Keir Starmer's office. He decided that he would shake up his top team with a shadow cabinet reshuffle, starting with his deputy, Angela Rayner, who is also the party chair in charge of election campaigns. But from that point onwards, the whole thing unraveled very quickly. Angela Rayner was furious that she was being made the scapegoat of the poor performance in the local elections, and the whole reshuffle turned into an exercise in mismanagement, to be frank.
What was your read on the fact that the incumbent parties all did so well? I mean, I know that people were voting for different reasons across the constituent nations of the United Kingdom, but was it, especially where Labour didn't do as well as they might have hoped, was it people being grateful that Brexit is done one way or another, or grateful for the relative success of the vaccine rollout. Incumbency is not usually a benefit in non-general elections.
No, it's a good point. I think you have to be a bit careful about drawing too many conclusions from elections held in a pandemic. And what's certainly true is that those leaders who have been responsible for the recent handling of the pandemic, notably Boris Johnson, of course, from a UK point of view, have been rewarded, and the incumbents have been rewarded. I mean, the vaccine programme is by far and away the most important thing in people's lives at the moment. Over 35 million people have received a first dose. It's an incredibly successful policy, and Boris Johnson has reaped the benefits. Similarly, Nicola Sturgeon in Scotland, the SNP leader, was returned with a very large 64 out of 129 seats. Again, she's regarded to have done a good job handling the pandemic. And also in Wales, Mark Drakeford, who was probably the sort of shining star for Labour on a bad night, he retained power in Wales for the Labour Party.
There was a decent set of results across the country for various Green parties. Does that strike you as significant? Is that perhaps where some of the Jeremy Corbyn Labour vote went?
Well, I think that's a very interesting point, and you're starting to see that in some other European countries, aren't you? Notably in Germany, where the Green Party is doing very well and picking up that sort of progressive left vote. And certainly true that the Green Party did very well. I think it picked up around 80 net seats in local elections. So one of the big winners on the night, apart from the Conservatives. And you know, I think green issues are very much coming to the fore, and they're in the news, of course, in the UK at the moment, which is hosting the UN Climate Change Summit in November. And the question of how we meet our net zero targets is very much in the news at the moment. One of the things I should mention is there's a drive by the government to increase house building in green field sites in England. And that, again, has forced many voters into the sort of green camp opposing those developments.
I mean, all that being the case, does Labour, do you think, now have to increasingly resign itself to the fact that it is the party of the urban liberal middle classes rather than the actual working classes of non-London, which is what it started out trying to represent?
Well, I don't think they can resign themselves to that because there aren't enough votes from that sort of the gradland, as it's sometimes described, sort of young, well-educated graduates, ethnically diverse people in the cities. I mean, it's all very well to win London and Manchester, as the Labour Party did last week, but it's not enough to give you a House of Commons majority, particularly if you're not winning many seats in Scotland, which the Labour Party isn't at the moment. So somehow, Keir Starmer has to find a way of uniting those two very disparate constituencies for the Labour Party. First of all, the newer sort of arrivals, the sort of that graduate, urban, big city vote, but also the white working class voters who live in towns like Hartlepool, which the Conservatives won last week, very much the kind of people who supported Donald Trump, of course, in that previous presidential election. So somehow finding a way of combining those two constituents is the route back to power for the Labour Party, but it's a very difficult path to plot.
Just finally, here in London, Sadiq Khan was, of course, re-elected as mayor in about the most widely predicted result of the night. Indeed, you could barely get a bet on him. But did his Conservative opponent, Sean Bailey, who was not necessarily regarded as being on the Tory party's fast track, actually do better than expected? Is London potentially actually winnable for the Conservatives?
Well, I thought that was very interesting. As you say, the Conservative Party put virtually no effort into winning London at all. They thought it was a write-off. They didn't really rate their candidate, Sean Bailey. And yes, he ended up with 45% of the vote. So I thought that was an interesting result. I thought it reflected a bit on the fact that Sadiq Khan, the Labour mayor, hasn't really set the world on fire, I would say, and there are sort of problems around, for example, public transport and knife crime, which may have reflected badly on him. But I think there is a sign that, you know, the Conservatives are still competitive, certainly in large parts of London, particularly the richer suburbs, where they've normally done well, and, you know, in some of the sort of more mixed areas as well. So, you know, London is certainly not a sort of no-go zone for the Conservatives.
George Parker, thank you as always. That was George Parker from the Financial Times. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24. And finally, on today's programme, a roundup of urbanism news with Monocle's Nick Manise. Nick, thank you as always. We will be coming in due course to the gratuitous Australian story that you have shoehorned into this roundup, as you always do, as part of what I like to think is our conspiracy to to seize this station for our people. But we are starting, first of all, in Germany.
Yes, in Germany indeed. And I thought this one might be quite up your alley. I sort of see you as a bit of a party boy. I imagine you do enjoy a few drinks at a nightclub. Is that correct?
I am rarely out of them, Nick. And the louder the booming techno music, the better.
Oh, exactly. And I imagine you'd love to hear that in your flat. Perfectly nearby a nightclub, hopefully. And that's what could be the case in Berlin, or that's what will be the case in the whole of Germany, really. And it is good news. We've started off on a negative foot, but it is actually a good thing. Let me explain it. So basically, the Bundestag has agreed that all of the country's clubs can now apply for cultural licenses, provided that they demonstrate they are focusing on nurturing the arts, so young artists, young talent, and program curation. The key thing here is that they're no longer classified as or no longer classified alongside arcades, betting shops, sex cinemas and brothels, but instead they're regarded as cultural facilities, much like, you know, a theatre or an opera house or a museum or a concert hall where you might see a rock band. And the reason I quite like this, and it should be said as well that Germany does have a really strong track record of putting funding aside to soundproof their nightclubs to make sure that they can cohesively fit into neighbourhoods. But the thing I like about this is it stops the potential of, much like perhaps agent of change laws, stops the potential of people moving into neighbourhoods, filing sound complaints, and then getting
It's that usual dynamic, isn't it? People move into a cool and groovy neighbourhood because they think the neighbourhood's cool and groovy. They then realise that along with cool and groovy, you usually get noisy and then start complaining that they can't sleep, which is probably something they should have thought of before they moved there.
That's perfectly explained, and I'm feeling very threatened by the fact that you're now doing my job for me. Do you want to take over on our next story then, Andrew?
I do want to talk about it because it is fascinating. This is a Jinja city in Uganda, which solar-powered street illumination, which seems like something that more places could and indeed should be doing.
I mean, it seems like an absolute no-brainer, and the reason I wanted to bring it up is there is obviously more to it, and I do quite like the backstory. So this is the second largest city in Uganda, population of nearly 1 million people. Back in 2016, it had run up a power bill with the nation's largest energy distributor of $3.5 million, and essentially the power was cut off to the city, no streetlights anywhere. And I guess to counter that, what they've done is they've slowly started rolling out solar-powered streetlights. You know, and this is significant as well because the area that did have the streetlights cut off was only a small portion of the city. There was large parts of it where there were no streetlights at all. And again, to I guess go to the global significance of this, the reason I like this is it's such a simple urban solution. And I think there's a lot of the time we're looking for smart city solutions where we're looking at sensors and you know, whole smart ways of engaging with the city, tracking transport, tracking lighting and the like. But this is perfect use of very smart technology in a way that is simple but also smart because it's cheap. They no longer have to rely on distributors and there's plenty of sun in Africa to power them.
Well, let's move along to your/our gratuitous plug for our shared homeland. What brilliant, marvellous, astonishing thing have our supernaturally bright and brilliant compatriots bestowed upon the world this week?
And naturally, obviously, best for last. So thank you for highlighting that. No, the thing I'm pulling up here is M Pavilion, which is part of, I guess, an annual architectural installation that takes place in Melbourne's Queen Victoria Gardens. It was postponed last year due to the pandemic, but they've announced the designers for this year's M Pavilion, which will open later this year, I think running from November. But it is the Venice-based MAP Studio, and I liked this because of the global reach of it. So it's the return of the M Pavilion to Melbourne, but also MAP Studio's Venice base is where the Venice Architecture Biennale opens next week. So I think both of them highlight or underline the fact that I guess the design world is back on track to open up and have people invited in for discourse around better ways of building and imagining our cities and our homes and our office buildings. And it just made me feel good and get quite excited about, the prospects of the world and the design world coming back together.
On that upbeat note, Nick Manise, thank you for joining us. And that is all for this edition of The Briefing. It was produced by Rhys James and Emma Searle. Our studio manager today was Christy Evans. The Briefing returns tomorrow at the same time, midday UK. I'll be your host for that as well. I'm Andrew Miller. Thank you for listening.